Hi, welcome to Amherst Reads. I'm Betty Rossbottom. I'm a food writer, a cookbook author, and also a blogger. And I'm the wife of Ron Rossbottom, who is an Amherst College professor of French and European Studies. And Ron's here with me today, along with our guest, Alec Lobrano, class of 1977. Alec also happens to be the uncle of Maddie Lobrano, who's a senior at Amherst, and his brother was the class of 79, and his father the class of 51. So you might say that Alec has Amherst in his DNA. So let me just start by telling you a little bit about our distinguished guest today. Alec, after college, ended up in Paris, where he's been for almost 30 years. And most of those years, he's been writing about France and its food and its culture. His work has been published in the New York Times, in Bon Appetit, in Gourmet, Food and Wine, Saveur, Travel and Leisure, and the list goes on. Also Condé Nast Travel. He's the recipient of several James Beard Awards, and I might mention that these are the highest distinction you can receive in the food world. He writes a very popular blog called Hungry for Paris for dining advice. I refer to it constantly when I'm here in Paris. But most important, and what we're going to talk about today, is that he's the author of Hungry for France, Adventures for the Cook, and Food Lover, published by Rizzoli in 2014. So, Alec, welcome.
Thank you very much.
We're just delighted to have you here today, and I might add that the three of us are here together after the days of the terrorist attacks in Paris. And although that was a very, very traumatic event, we feel it might be appropriate to look at all the wonderful culture that of food and of good living that is so indigenous here in this country. So we're going to talk about Hungry for France, which is not only a beautiful photograph book, a book that could be called a travel book. It has recipes. It will take you on a journey from the north of France and Alsace all the way along the coast to Brittany, to Normandy, and to Provence. So, Alec, with that introduction, I would like to ask you, how did you end up writing this book after you came to France? What led you in those 30 years to Hungry for France?
Well, the first book that I wrote was called Hungry for Paris, and Hungry for Paris was a combination restaurant guide and memoir, that book was very successful, and many people started asking me, where should we go? We're traveling to Lyon or Strasbourg or other places in France, so Hungry for France seemed logical, and my pleasure in having lived in France for 30 years and having eaten so well and learned so much isn't sharing it with other people. So the natural thing for me to do after Hungry for Paris was to write Hungry for France.
And I must say, I was thrilled when you did. My husband gave me the book as a birthday present, an early birthday present last spring. And I went to bed with it about five nights in a row, and I was stunned by the gorgeous photography, but even more mesmerized by the wonderful text that
you
provided.
Thank you very much, Jenny.
Okay, so Hungry for France, I would say, is a tour de France and a tour de force. And I see it as a colossal undertaking. I myself am a food writer, and I've traveled throughout France, and I can only imagine the days, the hours, the weeks, the years that must have gone into this. So what was the biggest challenge in doing this book?
Well, the biggest challenge was to not write something that would be the size of a small automobile, because you could write a 2,500 pages on France and where to eat and what to visit and its culinary culture very easily. So the real challenge was to edit things down into a format that was reader-friendly, usable, and commercially viable in terms of publishing. So the challenge for me was to, the book is arranged according to the regions of France. The challenge was to take huge lists of shops, restaurants, and hotels and edit them down, because I wanted to surprise people with places that they might not have read about anywhere else. So My selection is very much oriented toward a new generation of French chefs and food producers, unusual good value hotels, and the places that I'd really be sending my friends.
Oh, well, I think that's what struck me. I didn't see the big Michelin-starred restaurants so much. I saw new places. And this summer, I was in Brittany, and I used your book because it had several places in the little town I was in Saint-Priest. So it's very comprehensive. So this is a beautiful book. The pictures are just at every other page. They're exquisitely designed and styled. But do you see it as a coffee table book?
No, I don't see it as a coffee table book. I think it's a great gift, I hope. Read, it's a book to read, it's a book to cook from, and it's a book to travel from. And it's also a book to idly gaze through and enjoy Stephen Rothfeld's beautiful photography. That I'm very much indebted to Stephen, who's a very old friend who lives out in the Napa Valley and is an extremely well-known photographer. And Jane Siegel, who worked with me on the recipes, who's a very well-known food editor in New York City, and she works at Food and Wine.
Well, did you accompany the photographer and the food stylist on the shoots?
I spent a lot of time with Stephen because he doesn't speak French. And Stephen and I have traveled together for other magazines and newspapers for years. So we share a common aesthetic, and we know how to work together. So it's sort of a Mutt and Jeff show. So I was able to, when I could see what he needed, and a lot of the time we sense these things without even needing to sort them out, I would be able to facilitate or help him get what it was that he wanted. And occasionally I'd suggest photographs to him, and he didn't get his back up because he'd say, oh, I didn't see that. That's great. You know,
the best sort of
right,
work,
exactly.
Teamwork. Well, I noticed that there were pictures of what I would consider fairly complex dishes, beautifully photographed, close-in shots where you got every nuance of the dish. And then there were countryside scenes, interiors. It's just, it's really a cornucopia.
Well,
me, I love beautiful aesthetics, and this book definitely has that in it. So, talking about time that you spent on this book, how long did it take from the first flicker of your imagination for this book to turning in the final draft?
Well, from the beginning of the project to my being put into an asylum, it took about 2.5 years. It was vastly more complicated than I expected it would be. I'm very glad that the book is in the world. It's a miracle that all this work got done. But since it is three different books in one, it's a written book, it's a cookbook, and it's also a travelogue, it was like organizing three different books. It was hugely time-consuming.
I can't even fathom. You didn't wear one of those little things that clocks the kilometers or the miles that you have walked or traveled for this? You should have done it. So one of the questions I wondered about, because I, like probably many people listening who take trips, research an area before I go to it from the point of view of food and hotels and museums. And I'm wondering, here you have these many, many entries in this book all over France. Did you pick an area? Did you research it? How did your work go to provide the finished product? I mean,
well, I was lucky in a way because having been here for 30 years and having written for most of the major food and travel magazines, I've had sort of a graduate education in French culture and gastronomy by dint of the work that I've done. So I know France from A to Z. Sometimes at Paris dinner parties, I'll mention having been in Beach, which is a city on the French-Luxembourg border. And the conversation will stop, and people will say, "What in God's name are you doing?" but I have traveled France from one end to the other, so I had a great architecture—an architecture of experience—to refer to, and that helped a great deal. But there were many things, because the good news for France right now is that the country, there's a terrific generation of talented young people who are cooking, baking, making charcuterie, cheese, There's a real renaissance in French food right now. The word has not quite gotten across the Atlantic yet, and that was another reason I wanted to write the book. There's been a, for a long time, the old British saying was, you never get a bad meal on the other side of the channel. Inevitably, as the rest of the world learned to eat thanks to the French, people started criticizing the French and saying the food isn't what it was. I think it's more complicated than that. I think the distance is narrowed between France and the rest of the world. France has the same economic pressures on its gastronomic industries that exist everywhere else. And what's happened now is there's a terrific new renewal in France.
I see that, my dear. I see it in Paris, and I've seen it in the provinces I've visited. I think you're absolutely right.
Exciting.
And it's not only going on with the French chefs who are native-born here. It's from the people from abroad who are coming in and cooking.
Well, that's one of the things that I find fascinating. I mean, the internationalization of the talent pool in France is new. And it shows how cosmopolitan, open, innovative and the French are when they sit down at the table today. Everyone likes a good bœuf bourguignon, but they're very available to the French food is cooked by a young Japanese chef or contemporary French food cooked by Americans, of which there's several very good ones cooking in Paris right now.
Absolutely. I can think right off the top of my head of several. But I wanted to ask you, too, when you were going, say you were going to Brittany, did you end up there sometimes with a real hot lead on something from all your sources and then become very disappointed and say, that one was going to be cut? I mean, were there disappointments along the way?
Of course there were. I mean, my feeling was because I was providing a very tightly edited list that everything had to be excellent, which doesn't mean that they won't have an off night when you go. But if I had any doubt, it was immediate. It was eliminated straight away. I mean, I feel that... and I was people often ask when I do this work, do they know who you are? And they never know who I am because I'm reserved under another name. And I also wouldn't want them to know who I am. So I'm just like you or me, you know, anyone else.
You just answered my next question was, do you go incognito? And I feel exactly the same way. I mean, on a very small scale for my blog, I will review a restaurant I find especially charming or good for my readers, and I never want them to have a different experience from mine. So I can understand why you would go incognito.
I think it's essential.
But unlike Ruth Reichel, you didn't wear wigs or disguise yourself.
Ruth Reichel is a good friend and my old boss, so I will not comment on her wig wearing.
Oh, I love
it. I think that there are ways of being invisible without having to put on a disguise. I think it's all in the way that you carry yourself. And people who feel that they have to wear clown noses and things like that to be anonymous usually end up calling more attention to themselves than they would if they just sat quietly in the corner otherwise.
Yeah, and I think the real reason for going as just yourself is to make sure that they're kind and polite to everybody and they don't play favorites. That's not a good thing in a restaurant. Okay, so most of these restaurants, shops, cafe you mentioned in Hungry for France, are not the starred Michelin palaces. A few I recognize. And I think you touched on this earlier. This was intentional.
Very much so. I think that nobody needs me to send you toward the Michelin system. And my way of enjoying, interpreting a restaurant and the food I enjoy is rather different from the Michelin system, which is not to say that some of the Michelin restaurants aren't wonderful. I think Michelin has been a little slow in recognizing the new younger generation of chefs in France and in Paris. So my spotlight really is on these rising talents, and that's why the book is organized. I begin every chapter is a different region, and I begin with an essay on how I discovered the food of the region and what the foods are that you should try and sample.
I know, I love that part of it.
And then I go into the individual restaurant reviews and essays about the food and various other things.
So I think my husband has a question.
Well, I'm in awe to be sitting here with two such proficient foodies, but Alec, you said something about the you said several things about the imagination of this younger generation and how much more worldly they are in their knowledge of cuisine. Do you feel that they are aware of the, are they planning and cooking for a more than just a French world? Are they thinking, especially those deep in the provinces, are they thinking of Americans and Brits and Chinese and Japanese when they cook? Are they still in the back of their mind have, you know, the French terroir?
Well, I think that there are two answers. There are two main components to my answer to your question, Ron. One of them is that there's a sort of a international community of chefs that never existed before because of the internet. They all know each other because of the way that gastronomic media has changed in the age of the internet. People in Paris know what's being cooked in Singapore and vice versa. So this is and many of them know each other in person too because they travel. I mean, this is, you know, something else. The world is more integrated in gastronomic terms than it's ever been. So for an individual chef, I think that many of the chefs are inspired by the food of other countries and cultures. But on the other hand, in the very fragile economics of running a restaurant in France, being what they are, you have to remember that your best clientele is probably going to be the priest, the notary, and the mayor. And so you can be innovative, but it should be deeply well considered, and your menu should be balanced between innovation and tradition, and that's what many of them do.
So I wanted to ask you that to comment just a little bit. There were all kinds of little bonuses I kept finding on the pages of this book. In each section, whether it's Alsace or the Île-de-France or the southwest of France, you will include les étapes, which are the steps that you would want to make sure you didn't miss. And there are usually restaurants in that section. In some of them, there are les délices de la région, are the specialties of the region. And in others, there's le maître de goût, the artisan cook. So can you tell us a little bit how that part of the book came about? Because I think it really adds a lot.
Well, one of the first things that we had to do, we wanted to make the information in the book as reader-friendly as possible. So instead of running text, we decided a running narrative, which would have been cumbersome and too verbose. The book is divided up, as you explained it, Betty, between with every chapter an introduction, individual longer form individual restaurant reviews, then short form reviews, which are les étapes, which you referred to, and then I'll also do a portrait sometimes of some remarkably talented individual in that region. For example, in Alsace, there's a woman in a tiny village named Christine Ferber, and she's one of the world's greatest jam makers. She started learning how to make jam when she was in Paris training to be a pastry chef. She's also a very good pâtissière, but ultimately her passion was in making jam. And I think we think of certain things as anodyne or generic until you've tasted her peche de vigne, which is a special type of blood red juicy peach. She makes all kinds of unbelievably interesting things, including holly berry jam. I mean, these are all the flavors of Alsace in little tiny pots. And in the U.S., you can get her jam, I think, at Williams-Sonoma and Dina DeLuca and a couple of other people. But I've been to her kitchen. I've seen her scarred hands because she fills every single one of the tens of thousands of jars herself every year from huge copper cauldrons in the kitchen of a tiny little smoky bakery kitchen in the middle of nowhere in an Alsatian village.
That must have been, I can only imagine the joy you felt when you tasted that jam. And I also noticed, like, in Normandy, you gave a cheese primer so people would know, you know, what are the cheeses of Normandy. There were just all these little surprises that came through, and I think that makes your book just so much more imaginative for the person who's never even been to France to taste it through the pages.
It's a way of introducing France to people who have all kinds of myths and ideas about it, but it's a very original way of introducing France, even if you don't cook.
Well, I have to confess, Alec, that I teach a little class called Du Marché à la Table from the market to the table in a, over in Northampton near Amherst. And I'm going to use your book as a reference. The recipes are so great. I think I can go through all these 13 regions and I'll be set for the next few years. There are 75 recipes in your book. And I must say, there are 75 recipes which are, for the most part, on one page, which in itself is a feat, because this is French cooking, and this isn't all French home cooking. This is a lot of restaurant cooking or bakeries or various other food outlets. How did it come about that you could get the chef's best to share these recipes, or at least how they did them? And then when you got them, can you describe for us the process of getting them from the restaurant, from the bakery, from the confiture shop, to your computer, and finally to Rizzoli?
Well, I'll give you an example of the process, actually, Betty. There's a wonderful and very famous chef in the south of France named Jacques Maximin, who has a brilliant fish restaurant, which is in Hungary for France, just outside of Nice. And he's an ornery, short-tempered, charming, impossible man who's had sort of a roller coaster like career because of his temperament. And when I went to have lunch there to include him in the book and take photographs of Stephen Rothfeld, I said, you know, one of your great dishes, which is a sea bass cooked with a quarter lemon juice, a quarter olive oil, a quarter butter, and a quarter, I think it's white wine, is one of the most delicious things I've ever eaten. And it's vastly easy to make. I mean, it's a perfect party dish because people think you've worked forever when all you've done is wrap the fish up in aluminum foil and put it in the oven. And he smashed a plate at the chef, Mr. Maximin, smashed a plate on the floor and said, are you crazy? I'd never give you this recipe. It's out of the question. And I said, okay. Well, if you're not going to give us the recipe, we'd like another bottle of wine. It's a very nice and he looked startled, and he said, but Americans are also healthy. And I said, not all of us. And he came back, and he said, I want you to try this. This is my favorite wine. I'd like you both to have a glass of it. And I said, why don't you sit down and join us? No, I said, I haven't seen you for a long time. And he sat down, and the bottle slowly drained. And Stephen Rothfeld was packing up his photographic equipment, and we were getting ready to leave. All of a sudden, Jacques Maximin said, mais Alec, la recette? Which, for those of you who don't speak French, is, but Alec, what about the recipe? And I said, oh, that's right, the recipe.
And
he gave it to me. Yeah. And when I got it home, what I did was I tested all the recipes, too, because I was thinking of recipes for people who really, really love to cook and who love good food, but who are time-pressed, which is all of us, really. And, you know, I think cooking for, I was thinking about my friends who are all over the United States and all over the world, and thinking about recipes that they would actually make. I didn't want anything that was, I wanted every recipe to have a new technique or a new idea that people might not have come across before, but I wanted them to be recipes that people actually would look at and say, this sounds good, let's go for it.
I know I was taken, and I read cookbooks as pleasure. I mean, they're my novels, you know. And I noticed there was a chèvre dressing. There was a bacon cream dressing. There was a wonderful cider port from Normandy that had a little twist to it. There were so many things that were new and refreshing, and yet all on one page, not a long, long list of recipes. One thing that struck me is very unusual. I wanted to ask if it was your idea or a chef's idea, because there was no chef credited with this recipe, but instead of doing coq au vin with chicken, you did it with turkey. Is that right?
That was Jane Siegel's very clever idea. Because I think that when I first saw that, I thought, well, I wonder why she'd do that. So I asked her, and she said, you know, braising like that, we don't have roosters readily available in the U.S. A cock is a rooster in French. To get the texture of the traditional recipe, I find that turkey is a better substitute, and it's widely available and inexpensive in the U.S., which is why, according to Jane Siegel, she had that idea to modify the recipe.
Brilliant.
I think it's very clever, too.
Very, very clever. Mela, as they say. Some of the recipes that struck me as being great is, and I have the name now, the curried pork and cider sauce from Normandy. This is perfect weather to make that. and the grill mussels with snail butter. I only like the snail butter and the snails, so I think it'll be great on mussels. And there was a cabillon melon gazpacho. Would you tell people what cabillon melons are?
Cavaillon is a little town in the Vaucluse, near the Luberon Valley, where many people may have been on vacation. The largest towns nearby are Avignon and Apt. And one of the wonderful things that I've learned through the years of living in France is that most French people, when you say the name of a town or a region, they'll know where it is and what have you, but there'll be sort of a reverent sigh, and people will say, ah, les melons de Cavaillon. Every town, every region, even some streets are nationally known. There's this astonishing gastronomic literacy in France. So that Cavaillon melons, which are grown in alluvial soil near the Durance River, it's very well-drained soil. It's a very sunny part of France, and the melons are considered to have a particular texture and sweetness, and they are absolutely delicious.
My favorite. That recipe, I can make it in France, if not at home. After writing Hungry for France, would you be able to pick one region of your 13 that is your favorite? Or is that like asking you to pick a favorite child or a favorite student?
Well, I think I don't want any of the regions of France to be sulking tonight. So I'm going to sidestep this. What I would say is there were certain regions that I'd not spent a lot of time in before that were real discoveries in the course of doing this. And one of them is the north of France, which Americans pay no attention to whatsoever. The north of France is the region, if you head north from Paris, the largest city in the region is Lille, which is practically on the Belgian border. It's where the French Industrial Revolution occurred. There were textile cities, steel-making cities. It was a very prosperous, very hard-working part of France with Flemish roots. Part of it was actually part of Flanders, which is now part of Belgium today. The western part of the region was part of the Duchy of Burgundy. It's fascinating history. It's different architecture. And the first time I ever went to Lille, the largest city up there, I had an interview with Bruno Bonduel, who's the equivalent of Mr. Dole is in Dole Pineapples in the United States. He's the vegetable king in France, and a huge mock medieval office in the Chamber of Commerce in Lille with all sorts of fake medieval heraldry. And it was late in the afternoon. He's a very formidable man. And I went in and sat down, and he said, before you start asking me your certainly useless questions, there are two things you need to know about us in the north of France. And he said, in the north of France, we build with brick, and we drink beer. In the rest of France, they build with stone, and they drink wine. Do you have any other questions? Well, as it turned out, I had many other questions. But the food up there is delicious. It's hearty. It's a hearty peasant. Oh, peasant is a prerogative word these days, I suppose, in the U.S. It's hearty country food. And there is a real culinary culture up there that's very, very little known outside of the region. They make beautiful, beautiful cheeses. The beer is spectacular. They grow a lot of the best vegetables in France. It's very much a place to discover. And Lille is only an hour by train from Paris. It's a terrific day trip or an overnight trip. I know many people coming over here when they come on holiday are time short, and many friends are always asking for an overnight trip from Paris. Lille is one of my favorite places to send people, and they sort of drag their feet. And then the next day when they get home, they say, oh, what an incredibly beautiful city, and the museums and the fish restaurants and the caramelized waffles. So the north of France was a very nice discovery among others during the work of doing the book.
That's great. In fact, I don't know much about the north of France.
Go up there.
But I have a dream, which is to start with my husband around the north of France and do the periphery and then like a snail do the interior. So your book is going to be a great guide for that. Okay, so I want to ask you if this were your last day on earth and you weren't worried about calories or anything and you could plan a menu for a final French meal, could you share with us what it would be and where it would come from based on Hungry for Paris? That way you can mention many of these provinces or some of the dishes that you liked without hurting feelings, because this is your final meal.
Well, and this would be a real grand bouffe. I don't want to hear from any doctors who might be listening to this broadcast. This is a final before the it all goes dark. Right, exactly.
They wouldn't be able to put you in the electric chair,
would they? Or a coffin, either, for that matter. One of the things, I think what I would probably do during the apéritif, for the drinks before dinner, I would serve a pâté en croûte, which is one of my favorite things. It's an Alsatian specialty of various ground meats surrounding a lobe of foie gras, and then wrapped up in pastry. I could eat that until my gizzards exploded. It's so good. Then I think I would, to get things off to a somewhat lighter start, I think I would probably serve something having to do with langoustines from Brittany. I've never been able to eat enough langoustines. I've eaten my own body weight in them, I'm sure, and at one sitting for that matter. And langoustines, for anyone who might not know them, I think we know them as Dublin Bay prawns, but in America they catch them in Maine, and they look like little lobsters, and they're very delicate, and there's a little cloud of sweet, firm meat in their tails, and they're just unbelievably delicious. From there, I would decide to have a sauté of sep mushrooms, which we often call porcini mushrooms in the U.S., and I want those to come from the Auvergne, which is a mountainous southwestern central region of France. And I do them really simply. I just chop them up and saute them maybe in a little bit of hazelnut oil or grapeseed oil so that the basic flavor of the mushroom wouldn't be masked with chopped garlic and parsley. Then it would be time to go toward a fish course. We're doubling back. We're throwing our nets back into the sea again here. And there, I think that France, the sole that they catch off the coast of France is better than any I've had. And with all due respect to my English sister-in-law in France, there's nothing like French sole. So I would have a small portion of sole meunière.
Julia
Child loved that too. And for anyone who doesn't know, sole meunière is sole rolled in seasoned flour and then cooked in butter. What's not to like about that recipe? Again, I don't want to hear from any doctors. And from there, I would go on to something like a blanquette de veau, which is a veal stew, a long simmered veal stew with mushrooms. I love mushrooms. I can't get enough of those. And then from there, I would have a cheese course that would require 6 or 7 different tables. And I would set it up the way the French do, which is starting with the gentlest cheeses, which are the goat cheeses, and ending with the strongest ones, which are the blue cheeses. And as you know, the way the French do a cheese tray is to start at noon, which is where the milder cheeses are, and then they follow all the way through the different cheeses and end up with the strong cheeses. And in a good restaurant, the cheeses are served on the plate in order of the growing intensity of taste, exactly. And then for dessert, I would turn to the very talented Betty Rosbottom, who has just also published a wonderful, wonderful book this year called Sunday Casseroles, which I've been cooking quite a lot from, with the red cabbage and pork and ciders with the fennel seeds. It's one of my all-time new favorite things. And I would turn to Betty and I'd say, what dessert do you think should follow this pantagruel and cheese?
Anything that's chocolate. All women love chocolate. But I think, maybe that pâtissier Christine Fairbair would make something special in chocolate.
That's a great idea.
But chocolate, or depending on the time of year when you decided to depart, any seasonal fruit would be great.
Over
Well, Alec, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us in Paris, for cheering our day after a very hard week here in Paris.
It's been a huge pleasure, and as I said before, my pleasure, and having been lucky enough to live here for 30 years and learning all of this, is sharing it with you. And it's a particular pleasure for me today to be speaking to fellow classmates, current students at Amherst. I would not have had the intellectual curiosity and the courage to create what my father always called a life pulled out of a hat like I did if I hadn't gone to Amherst. I deeply valued the education I got at the college. And I'm just sorry that I didn't have a chance to take one of Ron Rosbottom's classes.
And I want to end this by thanking Alec, thanking my husband for participating, and quoting you, Alec, from the introduction to your book. Because for those of you who are listening, I think this sums it up pretty well. Some people look at a map of France and see cities, rivers, and mountain ranges. Well, I do too, but when I eyeball Gaul, I see menus and markets more than anything else. Why? Because France still has the finest and most deeply rooted culinary culture of any country in the Western world, and can also stand up to challenges from any other place on the compass. I think that just about sums up your book.
We all agree on that.
Okay. So,
vive la France!
Vive la France! Okay, thank you.
Thank you.